This is the Epilogue Audio Experience.
The views, thoughts and opinions expressed are the host's own and do not represent the views, thoughts and opinions of Epilogue Media Private Limited. The material and information presented here is for general information purposes and or entertainment purposes only. Listener discretion advised.
Welcome back to History Chatter. We are back with the third episode of our series on Goa liberation. We call it Konkan Uprising. The last episode ended with the takeover of Dadra and Nagar Haveli in 1954. That naturally made the Goa nationalists in Bombay extremely happy, and they hoped that India would now push for some kind of an intervention in Goa. Goa nationalists in Bombay decided to launch a satyagraha in Goa from 15th of August 1954. That is the Independence Day of India. Now, Nehru probably was a little concerned, even now. He was anxious that if Indians were allowed to cross the international border and participate in the satyagraha, Pakistan might use it as an excuse to send infiltrators or soldiers to Kashmir. Meanwhile, Nehru turned into a firm proponent of non-violence. It certainly went against his general outlook so far. His biographer, old biographer Frank Morris, the father of Dom Morris, was also a Goan, wrote that for most of his life, Nehru actually resisted the idea that nonviolence should be projected as a strategy for defense against external aggression. He told the parliament in July 1955 that India would not use aggression or provoke a war in case of Goa. Now, Nehru continued to preach non-violence to the world, forever conscious of his world image and his internationalist aspirations. He said, and I quote, "There must be peaceful methods. This is essential. We rule out non-peaceful methods entirely," unquote. On 15th of August 1955, Nehru told the nation from the ramparts of the Red Fort, "I declare here and now that we shall not send our army into Goa. We will solve this problem peacefully. Let everybody understand this clearly. India has decided not to use force," unquote. It is a reality that Goa really did not matter to Nehru. In a widely quoted speech, Nehru told the Uttar Pradesh Congress Committee on 21st of August, and I quote Nehru again, "Opposed as we are to colonialism everywhere, it is impossible for us to tolerate the continuance of colonial rule in a small part of India. It is not that we covet Goa. That little bit of territory makes no difference to this great country. But even a small enclave under foreign rule does make a difference. And it is a constant reproach to the self-respect and national interest of India. To take Goa by force would be easy, but police action would be contrary to the policy of the government as well as to the dignity of India. We have assured Goans that it is for them to establish their own future," unquote. Please note these words, "that little stretch of land makes no difference to this great country." Nehru's position on Goa did not change much. Goans themselves were divided about its future status. Most of them wanted integration with India, but some also wanted autonomy as an overseas state of Portugal. Yet others aspired for sovereignty as a quasi-nation with a loose affiliation to a Portuguese Commonwealth, as in India under British Commonwealth. Nehru said in 1956 that Goans themselves must be free to decide their future, so long as Portuguese authority is removed by peaceful means. Let us quote him again, and I quote, "We deal with national and international issues, and we've often to be very patient. It is this reputation we have built in the world, that we do not act in haste. We give mature consideration to problems because we try to function as a mature nation and have not taken hasty decisions or hasty actions. Therefore, the world pays attention to what we say," unquote. Now, there was a basic disagreement here between Nehru and the Brotherhood of Indian Socialists within and outside the Congress. Jayaprakash Narayan, Minu Masani, Yusuf Mehroli, Ashok Mehta, Ram Manohar Lohia, George Fernandez, and Barrister Krishna Menon, Siddharth Shankar Roy, Rajini Patel, they all regarded Portugal-held Goa not really as a small, insignificant stretch or as a pimple, but as an anachronism that called for correction. Goans were largely happy about Nehru's utterances. Those who stood for Goa's integration with India welcomed Nehru's commitment towards liberating Goa. Those who wanted autonomy were aware that their tiny voice would not move an intransigent Salazar. And they too were happy with Nehru's words. Those of the militant persuasion, however, were unhappy that Nehru kept reiterating India's policy of non-violence and peaceful negotiations. This oft-repeated policy of solving all international disputes by peaceful means would backfire against India when it was finally forced to decide to use force in 1961. But that is still some years into the future. Meanwhile, the dictator Salazar refused to talk and refused to vacate the last vestige of European colonialism in India. At first, he declared condescendingly that Goa was, and I quote, "the light of the West in the Orient." Later, the furthest he was willing to go reflected in his 1956 suggestions, which is, or was, and I quote, "invoke the principle of self-determination and let the people decide by plebiscite whether they want to continue with Portugal or join India," unquote. But then he quickly withdrew even from the idea, that idea of a plebiscite, when he was told that not more than 10% of Goans would vote for continuance of the Portuguese rule in Goa. Only once, addressing his National Assembly on 30th of November 1954, did Salazar speak of making Goa a sovereign state with the same international guarantees as any world state. He was definitely not serious about the idea and possibly trying to buy time. Nothing more was heard of his idea of Goa being made into a sovereign state after that particular moment. So the idea of a plebiscite or referendum in Goa was proposed by a man called Marcelo Matias, who was Portugal's ambassador to France and later became the foreign minister. In 1959, he became the foreign minister of Portugal. So Salazar's Council of Ministers rejected it, the idea of a plebiscite. They thought it would set a bad precedent for countries like, for Portuguese colonies like Angola or Mozambique. India, meanwhile, rejected the offer by America and England to mediate a peaceful Portuguese exit from Goa. Instead of mediating, India asked them to exert pressure on Portugal to quit. The diplomatic deadlock between New Delhi and Lisbon continued. So, left with barely any negotiable options in the face of Portugal's intransigence, India clamped on a terrible option, an economic blockade on Goa, Daman and Diu. Partially from April 1953 and fully by 15th of August 1954. The Goan Catholic political leadership in Bombay prevailed upon Nehru to enforce the blockade. They hoped that it would provoke the native Goans to rise in rebellion and would eventually force Portugal to withdraw and for India to take over Goa within a short period of time. It was not, frankly, a bad idea. Not totally bad or absurd a possibility either. In terms of economics, Goa's umbilical cord was tied to India and not to Portugal. Only 7.67% of its trade was carried out with Portugal. With India, it was 60%. So Goa's exports to India consisted of betel nuts, coconuts, and salt. And it imported from India food grains, vegetables, fruit, soap, coal, textile, cotton thread, tea, and tobacco. Only 1/3 of the currency circulating in Goa was Portuguese. 2/3 were Indian. So they did try to flush out Indian currency between 1942 and 1952, but all those attempts failed disastrously. So P.N. Khera, who wrote India's official account of Operation Vijay, the military operation that eventually liberated Goa, wrote that, and I quote, in 1951, remittances from India amounted to 680 lakhs, whereas those from Portugal totaled only 41 lakhs. So the economic blockade actually made sense, at least on paper. With the economic blockade, the flow of people and the goods by road, rail, and sea was stopped. Communication lines were cut. The accounts that Goan residents held in Indian banks were frozen, and money transfer from India to Goa was all suspended. This was all done to make the native population go crazy, lose their balance, proportion, and patience, and rebel against the Portuguese. Oddly enough, nothing of that sort eventually happened. Even though the poorer local people, especially the Catholic ones, who depended on remittances from close relatives, were hit extremely hard. Some observers, such as P.D. Gaitonde, wrote that from the Goan perspective, the decision to close down the Indian embassy in Lisbon appeared as an admission of defeat for India. It seemed as though India had failed to solve the problem through diplomacy. Now, as pressures of the economic blockade began to show, the Portuguese began imports into Goa. Rice from Burma, wheat flour from Australia, vegetables from Pakistan, apples from Japan, frozen beef from South Africa and Argentina, caviar from Russia, potatoes from the Netherlands, oranges from Israel, tea from Ceylon, sugar from Cuba and Mozambique, wine from Portugal, champagne from France, cigars and cigarillos from South America, cigarette and tobacco from the Western world, cotton yarn from Pakistan, cement from Japan, steel from Belgium. So the Goan Hindu traders imported Indian goods via Aden, Singapore, and South Africa to offset the effect of the economic blockade. The Union Ministry of External Affairs, the foreign ministry those days, and the Bombay police gathered intelligence on such Goan traders who colluded with the Portuguese. Now, those documents are yet to be classified. When they would be classified, there'd be plenty of suspects named, but that's still in future. Starved of money remittances, which were flowing from Goans working outside Goa, particularly in India, the colonial masters had somehow to shore up the revenues. One area or one strategy through which they decided to increase revenues from Goa was through mining. Mining Goa's rich reserves of iron and manganese ore. The first private mining concession was granted in 1929, but the production of iron and manganese ore was stepped up from 1955. Within 5 years, by 1960, some 800 private concessions were issued to just about anybody who asked for them. Extraction was manual throughout, but with the pressure of the economic blockade, mining was mechanized with foreign capital. Ore handling and loading into ships at Marmagao port was also modernized overnight. Mine owners actively abetted the colonial rulers in offsetting the effects of India's economic blockade. There was fairly good demand for Goan mineral ore, especially from Japan, which imported 40%, West Germany imported 30%, and USA imported the rest of manganese ore. By the end of March 1961, Goa was actually exporting 6 million tons of ore. An article in the Economic Weekly in December 1961 observed that the figure, and I quote, compared very favorably with, perhaps equaled, or exceeded the exports from India, unquote. So, revenues zoomed from rupees 12 million to rupees 30 million. Goa found new prosperity. The pivotal role of mining in blunting the effects of India's economic blockade is confirmed by the figures of the colonial administration. Mineral ore exports accounted for a huge 96% of Goa's export revenues. Mining operations were described nonetheless as haphazard, unscientific and wasteful. Yet, and Valmiki Faleiro is aggrieved that the pro-Portuguese and un-Indian activities of these mine owners or other traders who colluded with the oppressive colonial regime were not condemned strongly enough. Everyone who could did take advantage of the moment and probably got away from it. The list, I said a little while ago, is still not made public. The list that Indian intelligence agencies had made of suspect commercial operators. So, the economic blockade produced a result completely opposite to what the imposers had expected. Instead of economic depression, there was an economic boom in Goa. In marked contrast to neighboring Indian states, high-wage jobs and luxury goods from the developed world suddenly became easily available to Goans. Goa enjoyed a period of prosperity unseen either in Goa before or in India now. For the first time, Portugal drafted a six-year economic development plan for Goa. A provision of 20 million escudos was made for the construction of airports in Goa, Daman and Diu in the first development plan for 1953 to 1958. Under architects sent from Portugal, airfields were quickly constructed in Goa, Daman and Diu between 1955 and 1957. So, the 7-year economic blockade led to unwitting results. It demonstrated to India that Goa was not economically dependent on it and it could survive on its own. Imports of Western merchandise, especially luxuries like silks, fountain pens, watches, liquor, silver, gold, and precious stones, led to cross-border smuggling by locals. Ironically, they posed as freedom fighters. It helped them avoid interception and harassment by border policemen on the Indian side. There was a third unwitting result: locals masquerading as freedom fighters secretly carried contraband across the border and fed lies about the Portuguese military disposition existing in Goa to Indian intelligence gathering. Now, this would boomerang in intelligence reports and consequently on the war mobilization later. So India was forced, finally, to lift the trade embargo on Portuguese Goa on the 1st of April 1961. Nehru, the Prime Minister, emphasized that it was not an abandonment of economic sanctions, but only a variation to help poorer Goans. Under the new terms, only betel nut would now be imported, and medicines, cloth, books, tea, and leather goods would be exported to Goa. Now, that was the commercial plane. There were fairly interesting developments happening on the plane of Goa's anti-colonial movement. And that new phase really took off since the liberation of Daman and Diu the last phase of Goa's anti-colonial movement began on the 7th anniversary, really, of India's independence, 15th of August 1954, with the takeover of Dadra and Nagar Haveli. What really happened? The takeover of Dadra and Nagar Haveli was Portugal's first loss of territory in India. Some Goan freedom fighters immediately planned to start a satyagraha. But as I said, Jawaharlal Nehru was not interested. In New Delhi, an all-party parliamentary committee for Goa was formed on 5th of May 1955 to mobilize opinion in support of freeing Goa from the colonial rule. Many satyagrahis and Indian opposition members of parliament did enter Goa in small groups. The satyagrahis were sent back, and in a most embarrassing situation for India, the parliamentarians were arrested and jailed. Among the prominent Indian leaders detained were Madhu Limaye of Socialist Party, Jagannath Rao Joshi from the Jansangh, which was a forerunner of today's BJP, Rajaram Patil of the Communist Party of India, Nana Saheb Gore and Shirubhau Limaye of the Praja Socialist Party, V.G. Deshpande of the Hindu Mahasabha, and Tradeep Kumar Chaudhary from Calcutta, who was an MP of the Revolutionary Socialist Party. Now, Indian prisoners held by the Portuguese in Goa were, of course, eventually released after Nehru spoke to Eisenhower, the U.S. President Eisenhower in Washington in December 1956. India actually sought the Vatican's intervention in the release of both the Indians and Goan prisoners. Indian opposition parties were extremely anxious and angry and upset, including the Praja Socialist Party, Kisan Mazdoor Sabha, Hindu Mahasabha, and the Communist Party of India. They mobilized around 4,000 volunteers to march to Goa. The Portuguese were also anxious that there could be an invasion, invited some 40 international journalists to witness. Three main groups of Indian satyagrahis assembled at the borders of Goa on 15th of August. They tried to enter Goa from the frontier ports of Patradevi in the north, Polem in the south, and Caranzol in the east. Now, troops positioned inside the Goa borders were only European Portuguese, not African Portuguese. There were concerns that the Africans might run away with the guns, or worse, they might turn the guns on their European superiors. So Portuguese soldiers at Patradevi opened fire into the crowd without any warning. There were similar incidents elsewhere too. Overall, 22 died. 225 were injured and 20 went missing. But for the presence of foreign journalists, the toll could have been much higher. The following day, Nehru told Parliament that the Portuguese firing on Indian satyagrahis was brutal and uncivilized in the extreme. The killing of unarmed Indian satyagrahis provoked an immediate backlash in India. Strikes and hartals, closure of shops, offices, and transport across Indian cities followed. This led to more deaths and injuries as, and I quote, hoodlums who had never heard of Goa, unquote, took to the streets. In Bombay and Calcutta, mobs attacked Portuguese, British, and Pakistani consulates. India was roundly condemned by the Western media for allowing the violence on Indian soil, which was a clear-cut violation of each one of the five lofty principles of Panchsheel, or the cornerstone of peaceful coexistence, which India adopted in 1954 for the conduct of international relations. Jawaharlal Nehru apologized and offered recompense. Portuguese soldiers had shot and killed Indian satyagrahis. Yet it was the Indian Prime Minister who came under attack. Nehru was attacked from all sides, from the Western world for the assault on diplomatic offices and from India for the lack of support to satyagrahis. Now, what would happen now? How does Nehru respond? What lies ahead over the next few years? That and much more in terms of our final and fourth episode on Goa liberation will be ready by next week. For today, this is the point where I wish to end. India had a wonderful opportunity to take over Goa in 1954 and 1955. It failed. It did not take the decision to actually launch a military intervention. On top of it, it launched an extremely unsuccessful economic blockade, which backfired for the next 6 years. It eventually made Goa richer than it ever was under Portuguese control. And that's where we'd resume the story. How does India respond to this cornered, or how does India respond to being so cornered in the Goa question in the mid-1950s or 1955, 56 as it were. I'll see you next week. That's for the fourth and final episode of Konkan Uprising.